It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the cultural shift underway about the nature of sexual assault as Harvey Weinstein was convicted this week. So outside of Hollywood and the cameras trained on that Manhattan courtroom during the six-week trial, what will be the next chapter of the Me Too movement? How will your workplace change? Have you changed since allegations against Weinstein really ignited Me Too back in 2017? Your thoughts are welcome here at 800-642-1234. Shireen Alamzada is an attorney and the co-founder of Healing to Action. That nonprofit works to end gender violence. She is a legal expert on workplace sexual violence, and she's litigated sexual harassment, sexual assault, and civil rights cases. Shireen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with that verdict. A jury found Harvey Weinstein guilty of two felony sex crimes, criminal sexual assault in the first degree and rape in the third degree. How is this verdict significant?
Well, it's there's a lot of, so just to break down the verdict a little bit more, these were cases of different two different victims, Jessica Mann and Maryam Halei, and they were cases that were brought along with a third victim testifying that some of this conduct had happened to her in the past. And all three cases had some elements to them that typically, I think, prior to the Weinstein case and the Me Too movement, would have been difficult for prosecutors to bring. And so I think there's a couple of pieces of significance here. The first is that there was accountability for Harvey Weinstein, whose case was highly publicized, who became one of the sort of most prominent foils in the Me Too movement. And then I think the other one is that it was an example of how the criminal justice system is starting to look a little bit differently at cases like this, given perhaps that the cultural conversation is shifting to help to explain the public's understanding of, to clarify the public's understanding of sexual assault a little bit more.
What have you seen in the evolution of how we view sexual assault since Me Too started?
So I think that it's become, there have just been so many more stories that have come out that really give a shape and a face and really just a lot more detail to what these situations look like. I think what has become clear, one thing that's become clear is how prevalent this problem is, that it's happening to people across different industries, that it's happening to people from different walks of life all over the world. And so that's just helped to provide, I think, a little bit of cover for people to come forward without shame and really share the stories of what they actually went through. I think another piece of what's changed is that, you know, you have people really understanding in a lot more, with a lot more clarity, the choices that people are, that survivors are forced to make, that sexual assault is not always so black and white, that common understandings of how it happens are not necessarily the way that it normally does happen. And so you just have a better sense now of the fact that survivors often know the people that harm them, that they often have very complicated feelings about what's happened to them, and the level of shame and stigma that's attached to this that has stopped people for such a long time from coming forward is finally starting to lift. But now people start to understand why that shame and stigma was there for so long.
We're talking with Shireen Alamzada. She's a legal expert on workplace sexual violence. And we're looking at the guilty verdict this week of movie producer Harvey Weinstein. Have you been following the Weinstein trial? What do you make of the guilty verdict? Has the Me Too movement made you think differently about sexual assault survivor experiences? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Shireen, Weinstein was also acquitted on several charges, one being predatory sexual assault. Why was it difficult for the prosecution to prove predatory sexual assault?
So under New York penal law, in order to prove predatory sexual assault, you have to show that the defendant engaged in a pattern of first-degree rape or first-degree criminal sexual acts against more than one victim. And the verdict here, the jury found that he was guilty of third-degree rape against Jessica Mann, and then first-degree criminal sexual act against Miriam Halei. So there was only one conviction in the first degree. Now, if the jury had found that he had also engaged in first-degree criminal sexual act or first-degree rape against a third victim who testified, whose claim fell outside of the statute of limitations, then that could have elevated the conviction against the two other victims to predatory sexual assault, which can carry a lifetime prison sentence. Ultimately, though, it seems like what happened was that the jury only found, based on the evidence that they heard, that he committed one first-degree offense against one person. So that's why he wasn't convicted of that greater offense of predatory sexual assault.
Weinstein's attorney has made some comments suggesting that women are partially responsible for protecting themselves from sexual assault and harassment. What is your reaction to the sentiment from Weinstein's defense?
So I think that, you know, that's an easy sort of, I think that's an effective way to try to defend your client, to make these kinds of comments. I think it does certainly gloss very much over the power dynamics between Weinstein and the women who testified in this case. He was, you know, and I think that that's just one reflection or one example of how the choices that we talk about women or anybody who's experiencing sexual violence making are really false choices. Thinking about, you know, the question in this particular case, why did you go back? Conveniently ignoring the fact that he is one of the most powerful people in the industry who had, during some of the crimes that he committed, some extremely powerful political connections across the country. And really glossing over the real decision they were faced with. It wasn't about, you know, what the attorney talked about was, you know, why did you decide to go up to the hotel room, or why did you decide to contact him afterwards? The real decision point for these particular survivors was, do I want my career destroyed? Do I want to be the subject of vindictive retaliation? Or do I want to keep this extremely powerful person who has the ability to destroy my life happy? And that's really the decision that we need to be looking at, rather than talking about the responsibility that survivors play, is understanding and exploring with some moral clarity the choices that we're asking people to make, to throw away their livelihoods, to throw away their professional identity, in some cases to compromise their economic survival, simply because someone else has decided that they're entitled to their body. So I would really encourage people to refocus their attention on what really needs to be under the microscope, which is the brutality of that choice that we're telling people they have to make, as though they really have some autonomy or some agency in that decision.
You've been thinking about this notion of the perfect victim. Is there a quote unquote perfect victim out there?
I definitely don't think there is. And I think that, you know, there is always a way to normalize harm that happens to people and to blame survivors for what's happened to them. I mean, this goes to, you know, every example you can think of. I mean, there's stories of, I've heard stories of children being blamed for experiencing sexual abuse from a trusted adult. You hear stories all the time of survivors of intimate partner violence being blamed for picking the wrong person, you know, extremely vulnerable workers being blamed for staying in an abusive workplace because they need to feed their kids. There's always a way to turn scrutiny onto a person who's been harmed and say that they're not a real victim. And I think what's starting to change is that survivors, like the women in this case, are really starting to name the harm that they suffered, even though they know that not everyone is going to believe that they're a perfect victim. And I think that is extremely powerful.
Talking with attorney Shireen Alamzadeh right here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us, back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some questions here to think about. How have perceptions of what constitutes sexual harassment changed in the era of Me Too? Was this week's Harvey Weinstein conviction an indication that there is real change in how Americans perceive sexual assault? And one thing that's emerged is that sexual assault allegations can be complicated. They can be complicated by lapses in memory and the silence of victims who are in these professional or personal relationships with their assaulter. Has your workplace taken steps to change, to eliminate harassment? What works? Join in 800-642-1234. Shireen Alamzada has litigated sexual harassment, sexual assault, and civil rights cases, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Jesse is here from Green Bay. Hi, Jesse.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm so glad you guys are having this conversation. I definitely think it's something that we really need to be paying attention to. I just get concerned that, you know, yes, these are wins and they're momentous wins, but I don't think that we've come as far as we would like to in breaking down the victim shaming. And I think, you know, far too often we hear, you know, well, this is how to avoid it. And your guest kind of mentioned this before the break. You know, this is how to protect yourself. And I feel like we just need to really drive home that fact that if they didn't say yes, then the answer was no and nothing should have occurred. So it doesn't matter if they went back knowing this. You know, it doesn't matter if they went to a closed door. You know, none of that matters. The truth is there was no consent given and therefore their rights were violated. And I don't know where in time we strayed from that, you know, from an adamant and enthusiastic yes is the only way you proceed. But I really hope we move back to that at some point in time.
Jesse, thank you for the comments, the call. Shireen, you know, have we ventured too far from no means no? And is this a watershed moment or should we be very concerned about victim shaming?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's hard to attribute the direction of an entire, you know, cultural conversation to the outcome of a single case. But I think that certainly the case was a watershed in that it was bringing forward claims that a lot of people wouldn't have understood previously as sexual assault, not necessarily all people, but a lot of people in the culture that maybe didn't understand these issues very well and really brought them to the forefront. But at the same time, I agree very much with the caller because I think it's important to remember that the particular witnesses in this case that testified to their experiences did experience an enormous amount of shaming, minimization of what happened to them, blame through the legal process. And yeah, I think it's possible that more cases will be brought like this, but it didn't. This case in this moment doesn't necessarily signal that survivors will be treated with more dignity in the legal system. And I think what the caller is speaking to is that we do need to change the stereotypes and the misunderstandings in our culture that make humiliating survivors a winning strategy for defense teams, because ultimately our legal system is really a reflection of our culture. It's not a separate thing. So if we can't change those deeper cultural attitudes, we're going to keep sending survivors into these situations in courtrooms, depositions, in society at large. And we need to create the conditions where people aren't rationally terrified to come forward because of how they're going to be treated.
We're talking with Shireen Alamzada, an attorney, co-founder of Healing to Action. That's a nonprofit organization that works to end gender violence. Let's take another call now. Lisa is with us from Janesville this morning. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, I'm calling, and this touches on the culture issue. Recently at UW-Eau Claire, Chancellor Schmidt made a comment regarding, I believe it was the assistant chancellor, that other women had come forward who said they did not feel harassed by him. And I think that's the culture of, well, if somebody thinks he's a really nice guy, maybe that's not true. And as a sexual assault survivor, I can, you know, attest to the fact that when I came forward, I was not believed because there were a lot of people who thought that my assailant was a really great guy. And it's this cultural issue of everybody has to experience it or nobody experienced it.
Lisa, thank you so much for calling. Shireen, everyone has to experience it, otherwise no one experiences. Can you be the lone voice?
Well, I think, you know, it's incredibly powerful when people do come forward in those situations, and extremely difficult. And I think that a lot of times, you know, again, there's this, I totally agree with the caller that there's this understanding that there, you know, that there is just one way that sexual harm happens. And if it happens to just one person from one harm doer, that person might be mistaken or confused or telling a lie. But when you look at the Me Too movement, you see that there's millions of people that have experienced this, which means that we have to accept that some of the people that commit these acts of harm are people that we know, people we respect, people we admire, even people that we love. And that is, I think, one of the hardest conversations to have, is how can we create accountability for those people in our community, while at the same time not feeling like we have to discredit survivors who are telling the truth about their experiences.
You look closely at how sexual harassment and assault plays out in workplaces, and you describe the situation victims are in as an unjust economic choice. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's important, again, to place the Me Too movement outside of just the parameters of the Harvey Weinstein case. There's just across so many different industries, there is this choice that people have to make between their economic survival and putting up with sexual abuse or sexual harassment. And this happens in hotels, with workers, housekeepers experiencing harassment from guests, restaurants where servers are experiencing harassment from people that give them tips, factory lines where, you know, production workers are being assaulted by supervisors, retail workers being stalked by customers. It is a problem that is so pervasive, and it's really important that we understand that for most people that experience this, because the communities that are most impacted are low-income communities, communities of color, people with disabilities, you know, LGBTQ communities, that this is not merely a matter of, you know, finding another job or leaving or quitting an abusive workplace. This is a matter of, these are communities that have been historically impoverished by, due to a lot of structural inequalities. And so for them, leaving these jobs is literally sometimes losing a roof over their head, not being able to buy diapers for their child, not being able to put food on the table for their family. So there's these very real survival questions that come up for so many people when they experience sexual violence, and we need to be aware of, and we need to be talking about those kinds of decisions that we are forcing people to make when we don't address the problem of sexual violence in the workplace.
Let's really quickly take Mark in Reedsburg, who's with us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know specifically what he did. If I understand what I remember from past reports, he basically said, if you don't have sex with me, I'm going to hurt you in some way. I'm going to hurt your career or whatever. And under those circumstances, why would somebody not be charged with extortion? Because I think that is extortion.
Mark, thanks for the call. Shireen, can you comment on that?
That is a great question, and I can't speak to why specific charges were brought because I was not on the prosecution team. But there are, I think that the caller points to the fact that there were a lot of different legal violations that this behavior could be characterized as, and there's still actually quite a few civil cases that are pending against Weinstein, as well as some more criminal charges that are in California right now. So I think, you know, the question of how these different charges or how these different acts could be characterized legally is still playing out.
Yeah, and he'll be sentenced on these charges early next month, and his attorneys are promising an appeal. As you mentioned, there are also charges against him in Los Angeles County. What are you watching for here in this case?
I actually haven't been watching the LA case particularly closely, so I don't want to speak to it. But I think that a couple of things to just be watching for are how trial strategy or how things might be, how the lessons from the New York case might be applied to these other contexts. I think the New York case was significant in that it was an experiment in using certain theories of liability, as I mentioned before, that, and certain theories of the case that hadn't traditionally been used by prosecutors. So seeing if that pattern continues, I think will be really interesting to watch in other criminal legal systems.
Oh, seeing if there's precedent here.
Seeing if there has been, if there's strategies. So right now there's no precedent in the case because there hasn't been an appeal. There's no binding law in the case that could be applied to future, future defendants or future cases. But seeing if the case has set, an informal kind of example that prosecutors across the country might follow.
Shireen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Shireen Alamzada is an attorney in Chicago, co-founder of Healing to Action. Coming up, a Door County folk musician has a new album out. Katie Dahl joins us to share her inspirations, and we hear a bit of her music. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.